This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia and Kaz, and tonight we have Stage Fright. Yes, we're looking at musicals, we're looking at the origins of horror, which probably came from the stage and theatre productions, and today modern sort of theatre slash dance slash, well, slash productions. The Sound of Music, musicals that are horrors from stage to screen and beyond, and horrors that aren't necessarily musical, but horror that makes it to the footlights, the creaking of the boards of Broadway, on the West End, and of here in Melbourne. So tonight on Sci-Fi and Scream, we're going to be looking at the phenomenon of horror interpretations on the screen, from the stage, and even on television as well. And we also have an interview that was done with playwright Melissa Reeves of the exorcism horror Furious Match, which is still playing at the Malthouse here in Melbourne until the 13th of March. I'm Sonia and you're Kaz. And Sonia, Kaz, what are you doing?
Look, I'll just, bit of identity confusion there. Yes, as Sonia's mentioned, we're going to play the interview that she did with the playwright of Furious Mattress, Melissa Reeves. Sonia, you're also going to be looking at Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd, and we heard a track from Sweeney Todd earlier, well, as we came into the show, and that was God, That's Good, and that had the vocals of Helena Bonham Carter, which appears, I mean, probably in every Tim Burton film since 2000 or something. And we'll also look at that version of Stephen Sondheim's Broadway Wonder, a little bit of Rocky Horror. You can't talk horror musicals without a take on the Rocky. And Repo, the Genetic Opera, which looks like that's the future of rock horror. And you're also going to be looking at...
I'm going to look at We Will Rock You, the musical, which was set in the dystopian future. We're also going to be looking a little bit at Joss Whedon's contributions to the world of musical theatre through Buffy and his internet sensation, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Sonia, what would you like to see transformed?
Transformers, perhaps. Actually, that'd be an amazing stage production. The first film, I wouldn't bother with the second.
No, well, I would go all the way back probably to the cartoon series if I was going to draw. I'd probably draw from canon. Yeah. It would be interesting, really interesting to see how they can scope that on stage.
Yes, could be clunky.
Could be a little
clunky. Could be. We've also got our Facebook, so you can go to facebook.com/sci-fi-and-scream or joy.org.au/sci-fi-and-scream, one word, and check that out. Now, we're going to look at the history of horror on the stage. I'm just going to have a little look at that. And looking at one person in particular, just briefly, and that is Christopher Marlowe. And who exactly was this fellow poet and playwright? He was a contemporary of Shakespeare. That's Bill Shakespeare. And this fellow, Christopher Marlowe, was a playwright and poet, like I said. He passed out of the world very young and quite mysteriously. Apparently, he was a spy for the for Queen Mary, but we shall never know. He left a handful of projects which weren't published until posthumously, so after his death, and some of them were, for example, The Tragical History of Dr. Faustus, or known simply as Dr. Faustus, a play by Marlowe, based on the Faust story in which a man sells his soul to the devil for power and knowledge. And Dr. Faustus was first published in 1604, 11 years after Marlowe's death, and at least 12 years after the first performance of the play. And it's basically about an exchange between the devil and a man who believes that he has the answers to life, and a necromancer. The Tragical History of Dr. Faustus is based on Faustbusch, which was a dramatised version of the Faust legend, which deals with the Devil's Pact. Can be traced back to the 4th century, but Christopher Marlowe deviates significantly by having his hero unable to burn his books and setting him in a contemporary time of the time of the 1590s. So it's believed that There were two versions of the play at the time that existed, and the second version, which was the one that came out in 1616, which is the most popular one. And Marlowe, interestingly enough, may have been an atheist, which at the time was very dangerous indeed, holding implications that he was an enemy of God, in fact. But today, modern historians consider that his professed atheism, as well as his supposed Catholicism, may just have been more of an elaborate and sustained pretense adopted to further his work as a government spy. So there you go. And there was a lot of religious factioning in England at the time. So, yes, Faust is probably one of the earliest stories that have ever been put on stage.
With kind of a supernatural element.
Supernatural, yep, demons on the stage. And apparently when they first performed it in 1604, people in the audience fainted and screamed with horror, saying that they saw demons on the stage. But I think it might have been the actor's makeup, perhaps, the red ochre they were wearing on their skin, maybe.
It could be. Although, to be honest, I mean, people still walk out of movies now when they may not see demons, they may just be seeing what's on the screen, but they're very affected. I remember when Interview with a Vampire first came out, and that's a pretty tame movie by most comparisons. The audience, apparently people walked out. People were
really
sick. I think Oprah said she had to walk out of it or was, you know, sick in the middle of it or something.
Oh.
So I think from the time when horror first hit the stage right up till now, people, audiences really get quite taken into it. And, yeah, like you mentioned, it was interesting at that time because there was a lot of religious upheaval.
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, not like we have today in Western culture as such, perhaps more like.
But for England in that sort of post-Reformation time, it was very serious. And then, of course, you had when the Stuarts came into power, you had King James, who was very big on the whole witch hunting demonology thing as well. So you could see that come through.
And apparently Marlowe also did a play called The Massacre at Paris. Very lurid, apparently, it was. And it's a reconstruction of St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, 1572, when English Protestants were put to the sword, pretty much. So,
yes. So you don't learn a lot about
contemporizing.
It is, yeah. You don't learn a lot about Marlowe at school. Obviously, we tend to focus a little bit on Shakespeare, but I mean, Shakespeare had his fair share of ghosts and the supernatural in his plays, but Marlowe definitely made a huge impact.
And just quickly, Titus Andronicus,
yes,
Shakespeare, yeah, pretty much a super gore fest revenge play. And it's believed to be the earliest of Shakespeare's tragedies, written in the 1590s, a story of a Roman general in antiquity, where it's set, who is hell-bent on revenge. He's a heroic general returning from a war with the Goths in the north, bringing along Goth prisoners, and that includes the Queen of the Goths and her sons, whom he has put to death due to the death of his own sons by the hands of those sons. So, yes, it's a bit of incest, of course, a lot of bloodiness aplenty in this Shakespeare tragedy. Victims are raped, tongues and hands are ripped out and cut off. People are buried chest deep alive and left to rot. There's infanticide, there is gutting, there's plenty of throats that are slit, and blood is caught in basins for God knows what. There's also an interesting part where flesh of the slain is cooked and made into pies.
Yes, there was some, well, that's an interesting link to Sweeney Todd there.
But later, yeah. Look, we're looking at horror on the stage, the origins, and we'll be back after these messages. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream. Welcome indeed, Melissa Reeves. How are you this evening?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, Melissa Reeves is the playwright. Furious Mattress, that's playing at the Malthouse Theatre at the moment. Okay, so just for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about The Furious Mattress? What would be, in a couple of sentences, the basic premise?
Well, it's actually based on a true story, loosely based, I have to say, on a true story of a sort of backyard exorcism that occurred in the early 90s, where a man and some of his colleagues from a sort of small offshoot of, I think it was a Lutheran church, decided that his wife was possessed by demons and needed to be exorcised, and they conducted the exorcism over 3 days in very hot weather in summer, and tragically she, Joan Vollmer, ended up dying. And, you know, I read about this story in the mid-90s, like I think a lot of people would have, in the tabloid press, and just found it such a poignant, sad, you know, amazing story, really, where even after she died, a few of them sort of conducted a vigil in their house where they just waited for her to come back to life, like they could not believe that this had occurred, that the consequences of their actions would be so catastrophic. And I just found it, you know, really interesting material and sad material, and interesting about, you know, for a lot of areas about, you know, what, you know, how people get to that point where they think that sort of act is necessary.
Yeah, absolute tragedy. I believe it was in 1993 near Horsham.
That's right.
Yeah, look, it's a tragedy indeed. And I guess where our show's coming from, and that is science fiction and horror, is we have looked briefly, very lightly, at the whole idea and concept of exorcism. We will be going into that a little deeper in our show and our new season, of course, because there's such an amazing, very troubled amount of information out there of so-called loosely based stories that have been turned into films about the idea of the exorcism, including, you might have heard of, obviously, the exorcism.
Exactly, yeah. No, when I was researching, I read a lot about how The Exorcist was based on a true story, you know, and of course watched it and read a lot of the books that are around, particularly from America, about exorcisms, you know, contemporary exorcisms and exorcisms that go wrong. And, you know, it's a fascinating area.
It certainly is. And, of course, The Exorcist sort of broke the mould, I think, and then we saw a whole heap of similar films. And I guess it didn't really, it kind of still was stuck on the whole, look, it's supernatural, it must be, it's a supernatural experience that this young girl was having.
Yeah.
Whereas later on in the genre, we've seen films, which I'm not sure if you've seen this one, The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
I've heard of it. I've heard it's fabulous.
Because that's looking more at psychological illness, and in this case it was a young woman with, again, based on a true story, a young woman with schizophrenic episodes, and how she was basically not given the treatment that she certainly deserved. And unfortunately was, the story's pretty bleak indeed, what happens to her at the end. You definitely have to watch that one. But I think what is happening perhaps in the whole genre of horror in particular, because that's what we look at with our show, is we are seeing people producing films, and in your case, actual stage plays, that are actually questioning that whole idea of, well, it must be supernatural forces.
That's definitely true. I mean, I think I sort of want to have my cake and eat it too a bit. I absolutely question it, you know, and I'm really fascinated in what, I mean, in a way I've departed from the story. I mean, I think in the original story there was, I'm not quite sure, you know, it's hard to tell, but there was definitely some sort of mental illness. And I'm sort of portraying some sort of mental illness, but in a way it's a sort of theatrical mental illness, you know. It's like I'm looking at what sort of, you know, what women have to be in this society, what they should be, and when my character Elle isn't sort of providing that and being that, then the only answer that her husband can find is that she must be possessed. And some other material that I read that I found really interesting is about a sort of milder exorcism that happens in America. Have you heard of, I think his name's Scott M. Peck?
No, I haven't, no.
No, he wrote a book. I know, and look, I'm not sure this is right, so it might be a bit wrong, my title, but it's called The Road Less Travelled. He wrote a very big bestseller, and I found it incredibly disturbing, this idea that even these very sort of simple, explicable human emotions like anger and irritability and
sounds like PMS.
Absolutely. I go there a bit.
You know, like, don't we all go through that?
You know, we can cure them by that they are demons, and I found that very reactionary idea. And in a way, I'm sort of using it metaphorically as well. The idea of exorcism and being possessed, and the woman's body being possessed. Yes. You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, looking at the whole history of female sexuality, especially women are possessed at certain times of the month. You know, if they're heterosexual, they're obviously, you know, ovulation and so forth. And men have always been a bit, I'm just generalising, but male culture has sort of been a little bit nervous around that type of unexplainable. It now is, you know, it's chemistry, it's hormones and those sort of things. And I mean, in the 19th century, they used to have what they called hysteriums, which are run on a very low voltage of electricity. And you'll get the point when I'm saying that a lot of ladies, Victorian ladies, lined up, have a go with the hysterium. Because it was quite exciting. But you had to go to a doctor to be cured.
That sounds a much more enjoyable treatment than an exorcism later.
I think so. And particularly, that it is amazing to think this is only not even 20 years ago this was happening in Victoria, in Australia, a so-called secular, you know, rational country, and yet this type of thing goes on. Do you know of any cases more recently, or was this one that's the one that stood out?
Oh, look, I found some in, there's lots in America. Apparently someone told me there was one in New Zealand quite recently. I sort of researched this one the most deeply, really.
Yes.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be able to quote anyone's with any authority, really.
No, that's all right. We probably will need to investigate that, and it's good that you bring these sort of things up so we can look into them. Often we'll get listeners coming and SMSing us with ideas as well. So it certainly can open a Pandora's box, I think, the whole idea of controlling women, and that really came through when looking at the preview we were very fortunate to go to on the 19th, and that really stood out was the repression.
Yeah.
You know, and particularly the males and the lunacy, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I found myself laughing.
Yeah.
I thought it was just appropriate to laugh because I could see where it was going with the poor woman, you know, under such stress.
Yeah.
And you could see that it wasn't going to end very nicely, of course. You've got humour in there. How did you manage to include that without it going too far?
Well, yeah, I mean, some people might say it does go too far. I mean, there's been different reactions to the show.
I have read a few, briefly some reviews.
Yeah, look, when I first, you know, started approaching how to tell the story, I mean, I did find humour in it. I mean, I found it incredibly sad, but I also thought some of it was sort of strangely, blackly funny. And so I wrote a first draft, and then my first draft I looked at and I thought a lot about, and we workshopped it a bit with various people and stuff, and I felt like in that one, that first one, the people who were the perpetrators of the exorcism were a bit distanced from the audience. It was sort of like, look at these crazy people, aren't they... Aren't they fundamentalist? Aren't they, you know,
and just
horrible
write them
and
off.
Bad and different from me? And so in subsequent drafts, I've certainly tried to bring more humanity to bear on them, and also to sort of recognise that we all are so capable. I mean, this is an extreme example, but
definitely.
We're all capable of believing things that put us in a good light, and where we might hurt people or even harm them.
And judgment, you know, which is part of, I guess, the Christian ethos is, you know, you can have judgment on people or on whole groups. And in this case, it just felt like this poor woman, all she seemed to do, I mean, I laughed my head off when she was in the shower. She had just come out of the shower and she was singing Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights. I just thought, okay, she may not be the best singer, but really, are we taking it too far? Possessed? I mean, that's getting out of control. And, you know, this sort of story belongs pre-1990s.
Yeah.
Really. It doesn't seem to... That's what makes it so difficult. It doesn't seem to belong in our age, surely.
Yeah, well, I guess that's part of the fascination, you know, those stories that jump out at you and you go, what's going on here, you know, contemporarily?
How can it be based on real stories as such?
Yeah.
Now, just looking at the actual look of the whole production, the part that we loved, and I was with my co-presenter and we were watching it, Kaz and I, was definitely the more surreal aspects, I think, and the stage lighting, and of course the coming out of the giant rodent
from that place. And yeah. that was, yeah, I don't want to spoil it for listeners, but that certainly just took my breath away.
Yeah, it goes a different place when that happens, doesn't it?
Where did that come from? Did you have a dream or a nightmare or what happened there?
Look, I was sort of, it's so much about the woman's body in a way. You know, and I started thinking about male fear of women's bodies and what's inside them and, you know, what's frightening about them. And I just started thinking about it as a, you know, home for rats and thought, you know, so that's where it came from.
That's where it came from. I thought you might have had some sort of nightmarish, you know, image wake you up in a cold sweat one morning or something. But also the dancing or the struggle with the mattress itself, because I was waiting for the furious mattress and
where
the link was and that. And the whole thing about her being in bed.
Yeah.
And the invalid type of... Because I actually thought she was still, you know, around in the first couple of scenes. I didn't realise that until later, so...
It becomes clear.
I think
with the mattress and, in a sense, with the rat, I think, in a way, no one is there protecting her. You know, no one's sort of her champion. And I sort of think I've given the roles of the champion to sort of a rat and a mattress.
Yes.
That, you know, that, you know, at the end, they're all lined up against her and she has become sort of dehumanised and so it's left to inanimate objects to look after her. And
it was a mention in the Herald that... about the crucible, mentioning that, and I don't know if you read that particular article.
The play. I didn't actually.
That kind of made sense.
Absolutely. No, I did read The Crucible again while I was writing it.
I think it's
a terrific play, and it absolutely sort of canvasses the same sort of mass
sort of hysteria
folly, you know, group folly where people are taken up with something and absolutely sort of believe it, and or maybe not sometimes in the crucible, but yeah.
But it is shocking how it leads to the mass hysteria. One person dobs one person and then the others just come along and say, yes, yes, it must be true.
Yeah.
We saw the same thing. And
yeah.
People do get blinded, and that's really a microcosm in your play, because it's not like a whole village. It's just this one household, basically. It's very bizarre situation that runs away a bit like the mattress.
Yeah.
So what's happening for you next, Melissa?
I'm working on a few things. I'm actually I'm working on a screenplay of a play I wrote a few years ago.
Okay.
So that'd be fun to make a film.
Yes.
And writing some other plays. I'm writing another play with five other people a group that I often work with, who you know, just great fun to work with. It's great group writing on plays because it's such a sort of solo activity. So
you get the feedback that way quickly, don't you?
Yeah.
I've noticed that you have done work, like one of your plays was The Spook, which very well for itself, awarded the 2005 Looked For Drama in the Victorian Premiers Awards.
Yeah.
Plus two Augies.
Yeah.
For a couple of other plays, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Salt Creek Murders. I never saw that. It sounds to me like you've got quite a bent for kind of horror, you know, or thriller, would you say?
Salt Creek Murders definitely goes into that territory of it's a sort of serial killer in the frontiers of Australia in 1850, and it's got its nasty side.
So what is it that attracts you to that?
Yeah.
Because these are Australian stories too, which is really interesting that you cover that kind of, those kind of stories.
You know, it's funny, I wrote this play, this is years ago, but I was rereading it because she's about to become a saint. I wrote a musical about Mary MacKillop.
Oh, dear.
And I was rereading it, and in the whole second act sort of talks mainly about all these little group of nuns that were having visions. I thought, God, I've always been here.
What was going on there?
Yeah, I don't know.
A premonition, maybe. That's quite bizarre, and that's just my opinion. Now, The Furious Mattress is still running until the 13th of March.
That's right.
It's
got a couple more weeks.
Excellent. All right. So I definitely suggest that if you're listening, you should check that out down at the Malthouse Theatre.
Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam. We just heard Sonia speaking with Melissa Reeves, who is the playwright of Furious Mattress, which is playing at the Malthouse Theatre till the 13th of March. It was a really interesting interview, Sonia, with Melissa. She's covered a lot of interesting ground in this play.
Yep. It's going to the 13th of March.
There's a lot of issues, as you mentioned in the interview, deals with the story of an exorcism that occurred in rural Victoria. It's a really interesting play. Certainly some very disturbing elements in there too. We are talking horror and sci-fi as it relates to the stage tonight on Sci-Fi and Squeam. And we've had a few messages come through. Earlier in the show, we mentioned necromancy, and a few kind people have messaged in and told us, yep, necromancy is the alleged art of divination through communication with the dead, the black art. Yes, a necromancer is a person who conjures spirits of the dead. So thank you for that definition, Jay. And we've also had Robert from Northcote message in and say, we were talking about the era of Christopher Marlowe, which was sort of the 1500s to the 1600s. I haven't got that wrong. And Robert's just saying the whole era was suffused with horror, supernatural. For example, John Dee, who was Elizabeth I's occult spy master. And there's a lot written about John Dee and what he what acts he performed for the Queen and what divinations he did from astrology and that sort of thing.
We got a message from Grant from Gordon, and he said, necromancer Dracula. Thanks for that, Grant. Excellent.
Excellent work, yes. Mm. I think anyone who communes with the dead could probably be called a necromancer. Got a little bit of Sci-Fi and Squeam news for you now.
Movie and casting news. We reported last season that Tim Burton might move on to a new vampire project with longtime collaborator Johnny Depp. It looks like Burton is working on Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Word is the film is based loosely on historical fact, very loosely, no word yet on Depp's involvement.
We've had Final Fantasy, Resident Evil and Doom. But keep an eye out for Space Invaders, the movie. The goss around Hollywood is that rights to the film adaptation are being negotiated as we speak. Surely Pac-Man, The Hunger Continues couldn't be far off. How could it possibly go wrong?
Matthew Greenberg, who scripted the interesting but poorly received adaptation 1408, is set to tackle another Stephen King story, a remake of Pet Sematary, according to The Hollywood Reporter. The project has been in the works for a while now. At one point, rumours had George Clooney set to star in it. The 1983 book about a pet cemetery that rests on an ancient burial ground was originally adapted to film in 1989 with a screenplay by King himself.
Andrew Adamson, director of the first two Shrek films and the first two Narnia films, is set to bring a new CG live-action fantasy movie called Fountain City to the big screen, reports Variety. Script details are being kept under wraps, but Adamson will direct from a script by Joby Harold. The film is being budgeted at over $100 million, presumably US. Harold is also currently scripting the big screen version of Frank Miller's graphic novel Ronin.
And on television news, if you've seen Smallville, then you know it's supposed to follow the life of a young Superman, Clark Kent, in his adopted hometown, a young Superman, right? The show has just been granted a 10th season. Surely that's just taken it too far. Seems like they'll be filming this thing until Tom Welling is on a Zimmer frame.
For anyone who stays awake at night contemplating the new series of Doctor Who, that's just me then. The latest issue of British sci-fi mag SFX has an exclusive interview with Matt Smith. He had this to say about his first story in the new series. I think there's a magic to it. Stephen has written a rather brilliant fairy tale in such a magical way. The Doctor's getting to know his new body, which is just brilliant. Oh, that sounds weird. All the great stuff that Stephen's done with that. What's interesting about this particular series is that it has a thread twining through it. And you learn about that in episode one. And the Doctor's scoping it out. It's quite important for the rest of the tale.
Sunday the 9th of May, we'll see Melbourne host some of the stars of the TV series Supernatural. Jim Beaver, who plays Bobby, and Misha Collins, who plays Castiel. Down, boys and girls, as well as Samantha Ferris, who plays Alan, will be appearing at the convention, which runs from the 9th to the 6th.
That's right.
It's a whole day of supernatural goodness to look forward to. For further info, hit up our Facebook page.
Yes, we'll have a little bit of information on there. Castiel, obviously, very popular character on Supernatural. Going to talk a little bit now about Joss Whedon's contribution to sci-fi and fantasy, which we all, most of us know is huge. But he hasn't brought any of his wonderful creations to the stage, and it's surely only a matter of time. He is set to direct an episode of Glee, and we can only imagine that he will finally get Finn and Rachel together, only to kill one of them in tragic and unforeseen circumstances. Tonight we're going to look at two of Joss's contributions to making the sci-fi world a bit more musical, the standout Buffy episode, Once More with Feeling, and Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. First to Buffy. In case you didn't know, Once More with Feeling was an episode in Series 6 in which a mysterious force compels the residents of Sunnydale to break into songs that reveal their deepest secrets and fears. The whole thing was written and directed by Joss Whedon, who also created the show. Whedon says that a musical episode was always on the cards for Buffy, but the opportunity for it only really arose in the sixth season, and I think that was when they had a network change. Widely cited as a fan favourite, Once More with Feeling covers interesting ground for a sci-fi fantasy show. The two genres, sci-fi and musical, don't tend to go together, but Whedon makes a great case for why they should. The whole episode veers into hilarious and absurd territory at times, like Anya's song about bunnies, but the music just enhances the pathos of the whole situation. There are deep set fears troubling the Scooby gang and those around them, and things that they would never say openly are conveyed through song. Sometimes concepts and ideas that are explored in sci-fi or fantasy can be given new life through things like song, or they can have the edge taken off if they're a little bit serious. Once More with Feeling has a love song from Tara to Willow, Under Your Spell, and another about Xander and Anya's relationship issues called I'll Never Tell. One of my favourites is Rest in Peace, which is Spike's song to Buffy, although this could be just because Spike reminds me a little bit of Billy Idol in that scene. Whedon is incurably romantic in his stories, and I'm so glad that he gives the couples something to sing, obviously before he goes ahead and just destroys their happiness like he's wont to do. A huge revelation in the episode is the voice of Anthony Stewart Head, who played Giles, and his song Standing. I find his voice a little reminiscent of Bowie, and his talent doesn't surprise when you find out he has extensive experience in musicals. He played Frankenfurter in a production of the Rocky Horror Show, and has also been in Chess and Repo, the genetic opera, which Sonia's going to talk about a little bit later. He released a solo album that had guest appearances from James Masters, who often performs sideshow sort of performances when he appears at conventions, Alison Hannigan and Amber Benson. James Masters was actually the lead singer of a rock band, Ghost of the Robot, and has since gone solo. In case you needed more reasons to love Buffy and the gang, Once More with Feeling lifts you into a new dimension of fandom, one where you can buy the t-shirt, own all the DVDs, and host sing-along nights. And just on a personal note, I have two friends who can sing the entire soundtrack from memory, and sometimes that's fine, and sometimes it's a little bit crazy. We are talking about Joss Whedon and his contribution to sci-fi musical, and we'll be back right after these messages. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. We are talking about stage fright when sci-fi and horror hit the stage, musical or otherwise. Before the announcements, I was speaking a little bit about Joss Whedon's Buffy episode Once More with Feeling, which I know is a big fan favourite. Now, Joss Whedon also produced Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog for internet distribution, but it has been released on DVD and sold across the world, and it's been a bit of an underground hit. It's been described as a tragicomedy. It's a musical that tells the tale of Dr. Horrible, an aspiring supervillain who is desperately in love with Penny, but must compete for her affections with his nemesis, Captain Hammer. To really understand this gem from Whedon, you have to see it. Neil Patrick Harris is tragically dorky as Dr. Horrible, but absolutely endearing, and Whedon favourite Nathan Fillion is standout as the hilarious beefcake, Captain Hammer. Another Whedon fave, Felicia Day, plays the object of their affections. The film itself is split into three acts. In the first, we're introduced to Dr. Horrible, Penny, and Captain Hammer. Horrible is trying desperately for entry into the Evil League of Evil, and in Act 2, he comes up with a way to win over the Evil League and get the girl. The third act contains the climax and the denouement. the whole thing follows a pretty traditional theatrical format, and Whedon has said that some of the music was inspired by the work of Stephen Sondheim, and fans will definitely be able to recognise some of the influences in the songs. Dr. Horrible's was a real family affair. It was produced by Joss, his two brothers Zach and Jed, and his sister-in-law Marissa Tancheren. It was also independently funded by Joss Whedon, who wanted to make something without the boundaries and limitations imposed by working with studios or networks. And it just brightens my heart to say that there's a sequel in the works, and Neil Patrick Harris has hinted that he will work on it in the 2011 break from How I Met Your Mother. Sonia, is this something you've seen, Dr. Horrible's?
No.
And you've seen that episode of Buffy with the
I did see that. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was
many years ago.
Quite a popular sort of thing, and it's interesting because it's kind of brings that element of the musical into TV, which can often be quite hard to do. We're going to hear a track from Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. It's called Everything You Ever, and it's sung by Neil Patrick Harris.
Vampires, zombies, ghouls and creatures from outer space. No, it's not Federal Parliament. It's Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and that last track was Everything You Ever from Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which was a Joss Whedon production, and the person singing was the amazingly super-talented Neil Patrick Harris, who obviously found fame early in his life with Doogie Howser MD, but has also done very well for himself in How I Met Your Mother. And is a bit of an underground favourite with Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Now we're going to talk a little bit about musicals.
So, yeah, looking at musicals, of course we can't go looking anywhere else except to mention just briefly the Rocky Horror. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, of course, that came out back in 1972. Well, the film actually came out in 1975, but the stage play began at the end of 72 and ran for about 3 years, then made into a film, which was a flop originally, but it wasn't until the sort of mid-80s that it really took off with its audience participation. And Richard O'Brien was, in fact, born in England, and he's the creator, along with Australian Jim Sharman, of the stage play, and moved to New Zealand, Richard did, when he was about 10 years of age. His father was a sheep farmer, actually, just outside of Hamilton, if that means anything. And they were inspired by the Jesus Christ Superstar musical. Originally, Mick Jagger was going to play Dr. Frankenfurter in the film version, but that didn't happen, and probably just as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't have seen Tim Curry, of course, in his debut at the time. It was very suggested that it was influenced a lot by Man Ray paintings and of course, a lot of surrealism in there and the punk attitude which came with the garish sets and designs. Yes, so, yeah, it always starts pretty much with Rocky, and it sort of went through to Sweeney Todd. And, of course, Sweeney Todd is based on a fictional piece from the earliest of the urban myths set in London. Apparently, the person did not exist. The idea was that Stephen Sondheim, who did the original production for the stage in 1979, took the idea from what they call a Penny Dreadful, which is a serial, and that was called The String of Pearls, written between 1846 and 1847. And the tale of Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street, became quite a staple of Victorian melodrama. Later on, it became a ballet in 1959, many years later, and, of course, the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical, which took to the boards starting 79, won plenty of Tonys indeed. And if anyone hasn't seen the play or hasn't seen the film, you don't know what you're missing. Stars, of course, incorrigible, Mr. Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, Alan Rickman, Timothy Spall, and the wonderful Sacha Baron Cohen. It was a DreamWorks production. It came out in 2007 and directed, of course, by Tim Burton, who's got his Alice in Wonderland out there at the moment. You've seen the film version?
I have seen the film version. I thought it was quite scary. Yeah, it's really enjoyed awesome. It.
and with great lyrics like, "There is a hole in the world like a great black pit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. And it's the moral of the world and worth what a pig would spit, and it's called London. There's a hole in the world that's a great big pit, 'tis filled with people who are filled with shit." I love that scene when he's walking off the boat. He's come back from, poor Sweeney Todd has come back from being, sent away to Australia for a crime he didn't commit. And that's what he sings as he enters the very slimy, dirty, dark streets of London, courtesy Tim Burton's CGI and fantastic eye for design. The first time I saw this film, I actually got quite a nasty headache. I think it might have been the CGI, the moving, hovering cameras, and in general, the very monochromatic colours. But, look, whether it's a true story or not doesn't really matter. It just makes for good fodder nonetheless. And with a hearty appetite like Burton, as he often does, it goes full tilt ahead with lots of blood and guts and pies made out of human parts. On the second viewing, I became well adjusted to the maniac with the straight cut or throat razor. Call it what you will, I must say I enjoyed the blood splattering, and even the songs are worthy. So SMS in if you have two. Oh, look, someone has Alien as a Wagnerian opera. That's an interesting concept.
I think it would definitely work. I can see that. I can see that working very well, actually.
Yes, rather bit of a ruckus, I would imagine.
So we are talking about sci-fi and horror and how they relate to the stage. We've spoken a little bit about things that have already hit the stage, like Rocky Horror and Sweeney Todd. Also spoke a little bit about Joss Whedon and how he brings theatrical elements into his work. And Sonia had an interview earlier that we played with Melissa Reeves, who is the playwright of Furious Mattress, which was an interesting new work on an exorcism that occurred in Victoria that had quite tragic consequences. Another opera or musical, I suppose you could call it, that's set in the future was We Will Rock You. Based on the music of Queen and scripted by the comedian Ben Elton, We Will Rock You is set about 300 years in the future. Earth has been renamed as Planet Maul and is controlled by the Global Soft Corporation. Music is computer generated, instruments are banned, and rock music is virtually unknown. Two outsiders, Galileo and Scaramouche, meet and fall in love. They set out to seek Galileo's destiny, to the seven seas of Rye, of course. Now, as you can probably tell, the dystopian future of We Will Rock You is very tongue-in-cheek. The evil corporation is run by the Killer Queen with her officer Khashoggi, and the Resistance are a group of bohemians. Of course they are. The future is one of cookie-cutter pop tunes, and young people all dress the same, and corporate monopoly. You might be asking what's different to now, versus a time when it was all about the music, man. The show was pretty much panned by critics, but the audience loved it. The libretto is very light-hearted, and it's really just built around the great songs of Queen. On a more serious note, if you look a little deeper at the musical, exaggerated as it is, it tells a story of a future where creativity and difference are great threats that need to be neutralised. And we've already sort of seen those threats exterminated in our own history. So who's to say that it won't happen again and again and again in 300 years' time? We're going to play a track from that musical right now. It's the We Will Rock You musical, and we're going to play Radio Gaga. And that was a little bit of Radio Gaga from the We Will Rock You musical, which is set about 300 years in the future. You've been listening to Sci-Fi and Scream tonight with Sonia and Kaz. We've been talking about how sci-fi and horror relate to the stage. Coming up next is Raise the Flag with Aaron. And what are we going to talk about next week? We've got another interview, which we've been lucky enough to have with Amy McDonald. So Sonia's done that. What's Amy McDonald's background?
She's a creative writer. She also does yoga. And, she did a couple of short stories which were of interest, one called Credits and another one which was read at Hares and Hyenas, a ghost story. So we'll be taking a look at that next week.
Fantastic. Something to look forward to next week. Thanks very much for joining us in Sci-Fi and Scream tonight.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesized and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.